We are heading again to Deuteronomy. Today we're going to pick it up at chapter 16 and verse 18. We are continuing to work our way through what I've been calling the Jesus backstory. The backstory that is the Torah being the first five books of our Bibles. And so with that today we come to what is Parsha Shoftim. Parsha Shoftim picks up at 16 and 18 and runs through 21 and 9. Again, the Torah is divided into 54 parshiot. 54 sections, and today we come to the 48th of the 54 sections. And so we're getting close to wrapping up our journey through the Torah. If you're grabbing a pew Bible today, page 137 will be helpful. The words will also be on the screen behind me. And so let's go ahead and jump into it. Deuteronomy 16 and 18, it says, we read Shoftim, what is the name of our Parsha, the name of our Parsha, Shoftim, Vishotarim, which translates judges and officials, and then we get Titen Leha, meaning appoint. And so we begin here, appoint judges and officials, Behal Sheol Reha, in every town, Asher Adonai Eloheha, the Lord your God, Noten Leha, is giving you, Lishvateha, for each of your tribes. Appoint judges and officials in every town the Lord your God is giving you for each of your tribes. Veshaftu et ham mishpat tzedek, and they shall judge the people fairly. More literally, that would be, and they judge the people with righteousness and justice. And with that, then, we are off and running, beginning again with the appointment of, it says, judges and officials, what Rabbi Jonathan Sacks refers to as the classic source of the three types of leadership. And in part here then refers to the words of Rabbi Shimon from Avot 4 and 13, from the Mishnah, Avot 4 and 13, where it says, we read, there are three crowns, the crown of Torah, the crown of priesthood, and the crown of royalty. And it is this crown of royalty, meaning that of the king, that is perhaps most significant, or as Rabbi Sacks puts it, unexpected and powerful. Noting again, the Torah is speaking here about a king. More specifically, then, it moves into three temptations, again from Rabbi Sacks, and he refers here to the Torah, or to more specifically to Parsha Shoftim. It specifies three temptations to which a king, and by king here, let's think of the one who has power. The one who has power, to which a king in ancient times was exposed. A king, it says, should not accumulate many horses or wives or wealth, the three traps into which centuries later King Solomon eventually fell. The Torah, Parsha Shoftim, then continues, and if we drop down to Deuteronomy 17 and 18, it says, and we read, when he, again meaning the king, when he takes the throne of his kingdom, he, the king, is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this Torah, taken from that of Levitical priests. And so Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God, and follow carefully all the words of this law, think this Torah, and these decrees. And then it says, and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites, and not consider himself better than. This, writes Rabbi Sacks, is one of the genuine revolutions Judaism brought about in the history of spirituality, the idea that a king in the ancient world should be humble. That a king in the ancient world should be humble. The story is told about a man who comes to a tzaddik. A tzaddik is one who is a title in Judaism. It's a title for one who is considered to be righteous. In fact, tzaddik, at the root, it means righteous and just. And this man, he comes to a tzaddik, and he comes with a complaint. And he says, all of my life, I have tried to follow the advice of the rabbis that one who runs away from fame will find that fame pursues him. And yet, while I run away from fame, fame never seems to pursue me. To which the tzaddik then replies, the trouble is that while you do run away from fame, You are always looking over your shoulder to see if fame is chasing after you. It was Moses, considered to be the greatest leader in all of Judaism, who was, Numbers 12 and 3 tells us, was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. In a similar way, it was Abraham, considered to be the father of faith, where in Genesis 18 and 27, he says, "I am nothing but dust and ashes." Even more, it is our Savior Jesus. We could say King Jesus. We read Philippians 2 and 8, who being found in appearance as a man, King Jesus, who being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. And it is that humility that flows in and all through then the earliest followers of Jesus right down to you and me today. Nowhere maybe do we see this more clearly articulated than in Paul's letter to those in Philippi. And here in Philippians chapter 2, we get more of the fullness here. Picking it up now in verse 5, it says, we read, "In your relationships with one another," and meaning those of us right here in this room, "in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And it says, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself," again, "by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross." Noting humility, according to this passage, it is, we could say above all, it is first off, it's a relational mindset. It's a relational attitude, we could say, of the heart and the soul and the mind, right? Beginning with a right understanding, really, of who we are in relation to God. Humility begins with who we are in relation to God. John the Baptist, right? He was no doubt clearly aware of this. You might remember from our study through the Gospel of Mark, John the Baptist, he confesses, "After me comes the one more powerful than I, the straps of whose sandals I am not worthy to stoop down and untie." One could say John the Baptist was acutely aware of my favorite bumper sticker, which says, "There is a God, and you are not him." In the words of Henry Nouwen, the Dutch Catholic priest, theologian, author, he writes, "Our life is full of brokenness. Broken relationships, broken promises, broken expectations. How can we live with that brokenness without becoming bitter and resentful, except by returning again and again to God's faithful presence in our lives?" Right, point being, humility is the deep awareness of our own brokenness, of who we are in relationship with God. And so we come back again, we return again and again. As one woman wrote in response to Nouwen, she says, "As we struggle with bitterness and resentful responses to life's events, we often lose sight of God. It is so easy to hide tucked away beneath the scars of our wounds. One may choose to live there, hidden and guarded, feeling safer. Yes, this is potentially a natural response. But anyone who lives healed by God's unchanging love and grace will tell you that this is not living at all." In saying this, it is imperative that we offer up the brokenness within our hearts and souls so that Christ can truly dwell there. Right, again, humility, it begins with our relationship with God. Right, not what is not looking over your shoulder to see if fame is chasing you. Right, but it's this awareness, this recognition that there is a God, and I am not him. Right, I am nothing, to quote Abraham, I am nothing but dust and ashes. Humility begins with a right understanding of who we are in relation to God, and it finds expression then with a right understanding of who we are in relation then to others, to one another. Paul again from his letter to those in Philippi, chapter 2, verse 3, he writes, we read, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others, right, of one another. You might remember a story I shared some time ago. Josh Ripley, a junior in high school, stood at the starting line of a 2-mile cross-country race. And as you can imagine, Josh had one thing on his mind, right? He had one goal, one aim, one purpose. And as the starting gun went off and the runners began, Josh, now about a half a mile into the race, heard this piercing scream. Josh and everyone else heard this piercing scream. And as Josh came around the corner, he saw another runner on the ground, an open wound, blood pouring from his ankle. And it's in that moment, then, as all the other runners continued on toward the goal, the purpose for which they came, that Josh Ripley, he stops, he picks up his rival, and he carries him the half mile back to the starting line. It is in that moment we could say that Josh was not looking over his shoulder, right? He was not looking to see if fame was chasing him, right? He was doing just what Paul is asking of us, right? Doing nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility, he valued another above himself, not looking to his own interests, but to the interests of another. Stephen Matson, he's a writer or a contributor maybe to several magazines, and he connects this idea of humility to the events of our day-to-day lives, challenging us to consider how our differences, when we allow them to become center stage, unlike Josh Ripley, right? When we allow our differences to take center stage, how they can become toxic to our ability to reach out to those who are hurting, to help those in need. How in our differences, we are quite often less than humble. I think we would all agree that oftentimes in our differences, we are often less than humble. Matson, as part of this article, he writes, it is easy to get caught up in theorizing about God, but within our everyday lives, theorizing only becomes important once it becomes relevant and practical and applicable to our lives. He then continues on, kind of sharing what humility looks like, writing from the perspective of the one who is hurting, the one who is in need, while also then drawing out how our lack of humility can become toxic and can become a barrier to our reaching out to those who are in need, to those who are hurting. He puts it like this. He says, when I am sick and you bring me a meal, I do not care what kind of car you might drive. When I am hungry and you offer me food, I do not care about your economic status. When you give my friend a lift when their car breaks down, I do not care if you are a Quaker or a Baptist. When you help my grandmother carry a heavy load of groceries, I do not care if you are voting Republican or Democrat. When my kid runs into traffic and you protect her, I do not care what color your skin is. When you sit and you grieve with me after losing a loved one, I do not care how educated you are. When you love me in deep, meaningful, authentic ways, when you live a life of humility, nothing else really matters. Right, humility begins with a right understanding of who we are in relation to God, and it finds expression in an understanding, in our understanding of who we are in relation then to one another. Right, not looking over one's shoulder to see if fame is chasing after, but rather doing nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but to the interests of the other. And so I want to throw out a few questions for us to consider. Are we living this way of humility? Right? To consider my relationship with God. Consider my relationship with others. Are we living this way of humility? We could ask, do I live with the recognition there is a God and I am not Him? It's always a good place to start. Right? Do I live with that reality? There is a God and I am not Him. Right? Every day, every attitude, every interaction, every encounter. Do I live with the recognition there is a God and I am not Him? Another way to maybe put it would be to ask, how is my relationship with Jesus forming humility in me? How is my relationship with Jesus forming humility? What area of my life is God calling me toward a deeper humility? And then with that, we can think about our relationships together. Am I living the practice of valuing others above myself? And perhaps taking an inventory of your relationships. Am I living the practice of valuing others above myself? Am I living the practice of valuing Ian? Am I living the practice of valuing Noah? Am I living the practice of valuing Mary above myself? Do I consider the interests of others as a daily practice? Is that my habit? As I go through life, as I encounter others, do I engage others? Right, considering their interests as a practice. Do I demonstrate concern and respond to the interests of others? Do I demonstrate concern and respond to the interests of others? And then finally, and we'll sit in some stillness here together, how might an awareness of my own brokenness move me to greater humility? How might an awareness of my own brokenness move me to greater humility? Shoftim veshotetim titen lecha, appoint judges and officials.